I'm Tim Carney, the senior political columnist for the Washington Examiner. Welcome to Blogging Heads. I'm here with Annie Lowry, staff writer for Slate Magazine.
Hi, how are you doing?
Doing well. So I think we should start by talking about the budget, all the continuing resolutions, not the budget, the appropriations, really, for fiscal year 2010, which never got passed for last year, and so they've been doing all these continuing resolutions. And sort of the narrative that the New York Times and Chuck Schumer and Harry Reid and now Steny Hoyer are pushing forward is this sort of John Boehner is caught between crazy Tea Partiers and his desire to be pragmatic. So you've been following this closer than I, so tell me what you think.
Yeah, I think that that's basically correct. Certainly that is the narrative that Democrats are putting forward. I was at a meeting with some House Dems yesterday, and Anthony Weiner put it pretty funny. He was like, you know, at this point, their caucus is made up of crazy people, completely crazy people, and then like a few rational people, including John Boehner, trying to figure out what to do with the other two-thirds. And I think that, you know, probably calling people crazy is not necessarily the best way to move forward here. But I do think it's true that Boehner is kind of caught. And if you talk to people in the executive, you've talked to people in White House and Treasury, they basically admit that they think that what's going to have to happen is at some point they're going to have some failed votes. There might even be a government shutdown, and that will take more conservative parts of the Republican caucus, and we'll kind of show them that at some point they're going to need to compromise on something, that they can't be absolutist if they're going to govern. So I think that narrative is basically correct, despite all the name calling from both sides. And I worry very much that there will be, in fact, like, you know, I worry very much that the vote on the debt ceiling won't happen, or the government will shut down, and that'll be pretty deleterious for the entire government. It's not good. It's not a good situation. So do you think that
First, I want to distinguish between sort of not passing a debt limit fix on one hand and letting the government shut down on the other.
In other words, they're two very different things.
Not fixing the debt limit is unprecedented. We don't know what it would mean. People say, the U.S. would never be able to borrow, it'd be the same as default. I don't buy into those horror stories. I think the government would be pretty good at funding itself in that sort of situation. But also, a government shutdown, what does that mean? That means that a lot of our friends who are bureaucrats and in what are called non-essential positions aren't going to get paid, which is not a good thing, but that's not anywhere on the same scale as what you'd be talking about with the threat of a – sorry, I'm walking across the room right now to try to quiet my ringing phone here.
Yeah, don't worry about it.
And so it wouldn't be on the same scale. So those are definitely different things. Second, as far as the broader narrative, there's a degree to which it's true. And there's a degree to which, yes, freshmen are going to be a lot less interested in compromise in ways that are both good and bad.
Mm-hmm.
As a conservative libertarian guy, I think there's far too much compromising that goes on. And compromising often means compromising one's principles for self-gain, for political gain, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And there's ways in which compromise is necessary, obviously.
Yeah.
There's ways in which if you're not willing to compromise at all. There's always a story Tom DeLay's staffers would tell me about Ron Paul in the House. They would say, look, say I have 216 votes. I need to get Ron Paul. I don't have Ron Paul and Jeff Flake yet. I go to them. I say, can you get this spending bill, which slashes spending by 10%? And Ron Paul will say no, because it includes unconstitutional funding for the Department of Education or something.
Right.
And Jeff Flake will say no, it's still too much. So then what he would go ahead and do is say, all right, I guess I have to go ahead and either get Carolyn McCarthy or get Chris Shays, get a centrist Democrat or centrist Republican. And so the bill would go up another couple billion dollars with a couple more earmarks in. And so the DeLay people would always complain, oh, if only the Pauls and the Flakes would compromise more, we wouldn't be going to the left for a compromise. So there's lots of arguments for and against. I just think it's funny that Boehner, before the election, no Democrat would have admitted that John Boehner is anything but, you know, this rabid right-wing extremists. And now I think the reason to be skeptical of this narrative is that it fits too well into serving democratic purposes. And I'm not saying it's not true. I'm just saying this is why I'm skeptical of it, because you see what they want to run on. They want to run on, oh, well, these Republicans are completely extremist and they're obstructing, and the same thing that they, you know, they've run on 3 out of the last 4 elections. And yeah. So sort of telling this story, getting the New York Times to tell it and repeat it, it serves their purposes enough politically that – and then when – if we do get a government shutdown, it's more sort of believable to sort of blame it on, you know, 87 crazy freshman Republicans once you've painted them that way. And that's always sort of a funny game. I remember the last government shutdown. Mm-hmm. I was maybe a little too politically naive, but I was still in school, and I was thinking, I don't understand. Didn't, you know, both sides shut down the government by not passing something? I mean, it takes either one side caving or both sides compromising. And sure. If that doesn't happen, it's hard in most circumstances to pin it on one side. And I think most of what's going on here between Boehner on one side and McConnell probably, and then Schumer, Obama, Reid, and the Democratic leadership is trying to set it up so that if the government does shut down, it gets blamed on the other side. The Democrats would love a replay of the 95 government shutdown.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I actually agree with you here that I think if you're thinking in sort of just the crassest political terms, so not in terms of good governments or good economy or anything like that, you know, what's the best strategy for the Democrats? Mm-hmm. I think there's a pretty compelling case that they should just, like, let the Republicans be hamstrung and be very, very critical, not put forward a lot of legislation of their own, and just let the Republicans kind of, like, falter. And until Boehner can get his caucus together, just let them, you know, not pass and fail and let the government shut down and everything else. But, you know, from the other interesting thing that I heard House Dems saying yesterday, and something that I also think is compelling, is that there's no real strong, assertive message coming from the White House as to what the Democrats should be doing in Congress right now. And I do think that that's true, that they don't have a kind of affirmative message, even though I think it might be smarter for them at this point to take the back seat and do basically what the Republicans did really effectively with healthcare, in political terms. Yeah.
But see, there, I don't see what affirmative message the Democrats could do. Now we'll shift a little bit from strategy into substance.
Yeah.
The Republican message is government spends way too much. Now, obviously, we all know polling. That polls well. You mentioned specific projects and people get a little more protective of government spending.
Sure.
So I guess that would be the Democratic strategy would be, and this is some of what they do, come back and fight over specific things. Mm-hmm. But generally the Democrats come back with, oh, you want to slash Medicare, which, you know, Republicans will never talk about. Most of them don't really want to politically, even if they would want to in their heart. And so I think part of the reason there might not be a real response is because the Democratic argument amounts to, actually, we think that we need to keep government a little bit bigger than Republicans are willing to cut it. And I would think that, I mean, the idea of cutting government spending, especially considering that this is sort of a bill covering a year that is now halfway over, cutting government spending in the abstract, which is about as deep as any public, as any, you know, voter is going to get in his understanding, that that's more politically popular. And that's one reason why Democrats have trouble engaging. They would have to come up with a very good argument for it to be a winning argument when their argument is, yes, we need to cut a little, but not as much as they're saying. Sort of a Me Too cost-cutting bill position I don't see as a winning position.
Yeah, and, you know, I think that's right. And I also think that, you know, thinking politically, if you're a Democrat and you're very worried that the recovery is still not very strong, and, you know, I think that the concern is that if you're trying to not balance the budget but come closer to it and to get us out of the fiscal hole that we're in over, you know, a longer time frame, you're never going to do it with non-defense discretionary spending. This year, it's not actually possible, right? Non-defense discretionary spending plus debt payments plus whatever else are actually, like, bigger than receipts. So, you know, I don't think that Democrats necessarily want to have the fight about raising taxes in the immediate term, you know, until the Bush tax cuts expire again. But, you know, there's no reasonable conversation to have, I think, about, you know, unless you're tackling entitlement reform. And for obvious reasons, neither side really wants to get into that quite yet. Although there was something about how the Republicans essentially said that they weren't going to vote on anything unless there were Social Security cuts. I saw that.
Yeah.
Right?
And so there is, and that's something that is another, that's one of the real stories of guys like Boehner and McConnell being forced to act against their will. These guys do not want to talk about entitlements. These are the guys who are looking at the political calculus, saying these things are losers, and you've got freshman Republicans, you've got long-term backbenchers who now are emboldened and empowered, and they all of a sudden have power. So that's a real situation where I think there could be some real kind of Tea Party pressure being exerted on the leadership, is to force them to deal with very uncomfortable situations. You're right, though, that in general the Republican view has been talk about discretionary spending, talk about earmarks, things that don't address the actual spending problem. But I find that sometimes a bit disingenuous anytime I hear it coming from a Democrat or a liberal, just because the idea of cutting Social Security or dramatically cutting or reforming Medicare, I mean, because that's reforming means either hiking taxes or cutting spending. Neither of those are things that Democrats are willing to talk about either. Defense spending, even that, Democrats don't talk about it. So there's like two people in Congress who seriously talk about all this stuff, and both of them have the last name Paul, and almost none of them are on the left. I mean, are there any liberal ideas to get Medicare to be solvent again? I mean, to continue to be solvent? Or, I mean, Social Security, I know, is they count on this imaginary trust fund money, which doesn't really exist. So,
I mean, I think you can agree with me that Social Security is far less of a problem than Medicare and Medicaid.
Yeah.
And certainly not a problem that needs to be addressed quickly.
I don't know about that. Because, again, if starting this year, it's paying out more than it's taking in. And the way it supposedly pays for it is through a trust fund, which is essentially IOUs from the taxpayer, meaning the money effectively has to come from general revenue to pay for it. So Social Security is now not paying its own bills. And we can blame that on whoever in the past, but it's true today.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, so I agree with you, and yeah, this one-time demographic shift is going to be difficult, but yeah, I mean, I think that you're right that it's hard to talk about Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security for Democrats, and that there's a bit of disingenuous here. I mean, I think that probably maybe the answer to the political question there is that they did something with the fiscal commission, and they at least brought forth a semi-coherent plan as to how you would get from A to B in terms of making the numbers work, and it's obviously a plan that Democrats completely and entirely reject. And I agree with you that both of them exist in this kind of fantasy world in which somehow magically we will either cut on one side, on Democrat side, we will raise taxes in a way that I'm not sure that you will have Republicans let you do. Or you cut non-defense discretionary spending in a way that Republicans would do, and both of those are not really realistic. So I agree with you that the conversation is kind of weird, and that, yeah, maybe when you're talking about, like, brutally sort of just making the numbers work, it's very few people who talk about actually doing it. It's, you know, Paul Ryan and Ron Paul. And even then, you know, a lot of the ideas aren't workable and certainly not politically passable. So it's a totally crummy situation and kind of depressing to talk about in the long term.
So let's use depressing to talk about in the long term with a shift to first let's talk about Warren Buffett and railroads, because he says that he's betting on America by betting on railroads. This was your piece. I know it's a couple weeks old, but working on the railroad, which is sort of a great, it's a non-SEO headline. It's almost like a newspaper headline. I was very tickled by how old fashioned that was. So what did you find talking about that?
Well, it's kind of interesting that Warren Buffett made a lot of big bets next year, but the bet that he was most excited about and profiting on most when everybody else was, you know, when you talk about like kind of the investment stories of 2010, there's a lot of people looking to Asia for returns. There were a lot of people like sort of investing in a bunch of tech startups. And Warren Buffett, in his infinite wisdom, was like railroads, and he bought a railroad. And it's a great business. It's hard because it, you know, it requires a lot of capital improvements. They're kind of expensive to run, but there's actually, you know, realize I read a lot about them, and I didn't know as much about them as I wanted to when I started reading this piece. But they have just, like, kind of fantastic businesses, and they're really cost-efficient for the most part, and they're really environmentally friendly. Like, it's much, much, much less – it's much greener to send something by train than it is by long-haul trucking. And so Warren Buffett bought this company, and it's having these great returns. Because as gas prices go up, people get more sensitive to them, obviously, mm-hmm. and send more stuff by rail. So that was kind of the gist of the piece. Although in the end, got into a little bit about, and this is something that I wish that it was in my mind the big fault of the piece was sort of separating out a little bit more clearly the differences between freight and mm-hmm. passenger rail and how they're funded and how they work. And so I think this might be someplace that you might want to talk
about.
Well,
yeah, I mean, because obviously. I see increasingly the way that businessmen, especially if you look at hedge funds and venture capital, increasingly many of them are playing off of government and trying to get either
– sure.
And I don't think Buffett is doing this, but a lot of them just try to bet on things that have value only because of government. A lot of green energy is that – I mean, the idea of carbon credits at General Electric is bought into and Goldman used to be bought into. That obviously is almost zero value without – government action. Buffett's purchase of the railroad was around the time that Obama was pushing for more government funding. Now, when Obama was selling it, he was up there with Joe Biden, of course, talking about passenger rail. We could be like Europe where you're not, you know, you get on a train in the middle of the city and zoom, next thing you know, you've just gone from Cleveland, Ohio, down to Louisville, Kentucky in no time without getting in a car. And so he was selling it on those things that people would get more excited about. But I know that at least General Electric saw freight rail as one of the things that would benefit from both stimulus money and other legislation they wanted to push forward. GE, and one of the things that you're investing in are batteries that can power these trains, very different sort of battery than the battery that would power a car. It's more about long haul than about quick acceleration, different technology there, I guess. But again, those battery factories are getting subsidies and applying for stimulus grants and applying for special tax credits.
Yeah.
And so when I saw – well, first of all, my story about – one of the things I do, especially I used to do when I was a lobbying editor at the Examiner, was I would read all the daily – all the lobbying filings that come in every day. And a lot of time, you know, there'll be quarterly filings, there'll be registrations. Sometimes there are amendments. And I don't read the amended filings very often. But I noticed that, what was the name of the railroad again? It was Burlington Northern Santa Fe.
Yeah. It's now, I think it's legally, it's acronym.
BNSF, like KFC and NPR. So BNSF files something like 13 amendments to its past lobbying reforms. Its past lobbying registrations on one day. And I had no idea what that was about. And I sort of called around, tried to figure it out. Nobody would talk to me. I couldn't even get a call back from the press office. 18 hours later, they announced that Berkshire Hathaway has just bought them up. I thought about this as an investment strategy, but then I saw lots of other reasons why people do this, including getting sued. So I don't advise this, looking for lobbying registration amendments as an investment strategy. That is just about dotting I's and crossing T's there. But
uh-huh.
It was also a reminder that that a lot of these guys who are investing, including Warren Buffett, are increasingly investing in government. Buffett said it explicitly right around the time of the height of the financial panic in late 08. He said, I wouldn't be investing $500 billion in Goldman Sachs if it wasn't for my confidence that the government would make action. And he made money off of the bailout. He bet on the bailout and made money off
it.
And so from the free market argument for why all of a society gets richer with less government is that if wealth is allocated according to the judgment of investors who are personally invested and the desires of consumers who are deciding what they want, that will be the most efficient allocation of wealth. And that otherwise, the wealth gets allocated by government politically, according to what's politically popular, politically favorable. But you see a multiplier effect here, where if the government says, we're going to put money in rail, then private money follows. And that's explicitly the point of a lot of the stimulus money, the way Obama talks about it. And that could, and the more that it's infrastructure, the more it could really be harmful. In other words, if you just throw money, $50 million at some earmark, that's gone one time, it's over, divided among all the taxpayers, you know, it's 50 cents or something. But when you build an infrastructure that then lots of people will be spending lots of money on, it has the capability to really cause a long-term drain on the economy. So sort of investing for government is, to me, a worrisome thing.
Sure. It's kind of interesting because I think that some of the folks who write about green issues would point out that the reason that we have such a car-centric transportation infrastructure mm-hmm. is in a lot of ways due to, you know, like government lobbying yep. and big corporate interest, and that's proven to be a really, really bad thing. So if you consider train as an alternative to that, it's kind of funny that they're also, you know, I don't know that much about how much BNSF gets subsidized mm-hmm. by the government or gets, you know, certain, like, yeah. I don't actually know too much about the structure of how that works. But yeah, I'm not surprised to hear that there was some sort of, you know, reason that BNSF became better because of that. Although, I mean, I do think that a lot of the money that the Obama administration wanted to spend was actually on something very different. That's, you know, it's somewhat related, but the tracks that BNSF's train's running on are these like sort of old tracks that like they kind of curve and the trains don't go mm-hmm. very quickly. Whereas what Obama has really focused on is high speed passenger rail, which is like an entirely different beast and goes on very different tracks that have to run very straight and that have to be, you know, essentially laid down. And I do think that there's like, there has to necessarily be a government role there, right? Because of the cost of building and the legal issues around actually getting the land and the space to build. But, you know, it's one of these things that I wish, you know, I actually grew up mostly, well, for a long time in Europe and used the trains there. And I wish that the United States had the high-speed rail that they have over there. And I think that, you know, we'll just never get it. I think it'll always be a political loser, and it's kind of a, you know, for better or worse, I just don't think it will ever happen.
But there's also reason.
Especially between L.A. and San Francisco, I wish it would happen. But
I mean, I don't know how many people there would be to take it. It might have been.
I think it depends on where it
is. One of the blogs, I read about it, and they were talking about Japan mm-hmm. and the percentage of the population that was in, you know, a 400-mile stretch or whatever of Japan that was gigantic, and that made sense for it. And I mean, and just Miami to Boston would be huge. Mm-hmm. And forget about going from, you know, New York out to San Francisco by way of Nebraska. But the, I mean, by saying that, sure. I'm actually making an analogy to I-80, which you were talking about.
Right.
When I talk to libertarians often, because I've got a sort of old fashioned small town type sentimentality to myself, and I say, you know, without government, yes, there would be lots of other great innovations that never happened, but we wouldn't have the interstate highway system we have now. First of all,
sure.
Washington wouldn't be the hub that it is, thankfully. And maybe there'd be New York to Boston and even New York to Buffalo. Who knows what would be different? But nobody ever would have built a highway from the George Washington Bridge to the Golden Gate Bridge. That wouldn't have happened. So for better or worse, if you're a libertarian. But also when I talked to oil guys, talked to an oil executive once about subsidies, he said, you know, the biggest subsidy I get is roads. Yeah, we pay a gas tax,
yeah.
but that's the main thing. If every road was tolled or was all somehow fully paid for by a gas tax, I mean, but better yet, tolled,
mm-hmm.
there might be less driving. So I think I've talked about it on Vlogging Heads before. This is my sort of great environmentalist proposal. Instead of subsidizing rail and transit to make up for subsidies in driving, let's end all the subsidies for driving and toll all the highways and make them all pay for themselves. And if they're not paying for themselves, you know, tear them up and turn them into organic community beet farms or whatever.
Organic community beet farms. Yeah, it's funny. I think that there's also a liberal-libertarian convergence on the idea of just ending all energy subsidies,
yep.
including for green energy. You know, idea being that if you took away the massive subsidies to oil and gas, you know, you would make all of the green energies more competitive, even if you took away their subsidies, too.
Well, I don't know. The per kilowatt hour subsidy for wind is just immense. Like, it's
uh-huh.
I would take away the subsidies for all energy, and I think we'd have a lot of coal. I mean, coal is this magic little thing where God took some dead trees and packed all the energy he could into as small and portable of a rock as it could. The nuclear is an interesting question, because at least in the U.S., they're subsidized because their liability is, and I don't know all the details. I was talking to an insurance industry guy today for some of the background, but they don't
yeah.
have to pay insurance for all of the potential liability that they have.
Sure.
That's all backed up by the government. There's a law passed in the 1950s, so that's subsidized. oil subsidies probably have to do similar things. Like drilling, as we saw with BP, they didn't have to pay for the totality of their or they did, but that it took sort of an Obama kind of ad hoc action to make that happen.
And obviously, they aren't they certainly the coal industry, you know, in that scenario, you would want them to pay for the environmental damage that they cause. But this is maybe a good segue into the third thing that we were going to talk about, which is the sorry state of Japan and the very scary nuclear terror that has followed on the really the earthquake and the tsunami of kind of biblical proportions over there. One of the things we were going to talk about is aid. I wrote this article. It was funny, while I was writing my article, I sort of popped up and Felix Salmon had written, you know, essentially a version of what I was writing, which is always, Felix is always writing things I want to write and usually writing them better. But the point just being, and his article was actually a little bit different than mine and a much stronger argument. I was just saying that essentially people who are donating to Japan should donate smartly and should donate to general funds as opposed to very specific, you know, sort of causes, because particularly because Japan is a wealthy country, and the government and its Red Cross and, you know, a few of its other big aid agencies are primarily the ones who are doing everything right now. Some of them aren't even accepting foreign donations, and Japan has refused, politely declined most offers of aid from other countries. We don't really know what the rebuilding effort is going to look like and what Japanese people will need aid-wise right now. But Americans have been very generous. So that was the kind of point.
Yeah, and my brother John Carney at CNBC wrote a piece too, and he got yelled at by a lot of people because his headline was "Don't give to Japan." But he made the same argument, and you know the Red Cross wasn't take. I think Felix was the one who pointed out the Red Cross wasn't sort of importing Red Cross workers from outside of Japan because they had 1,000 people there on the ground and didn't know exactly what they were going to do with them yet. And so there is a very natural instinct to want to give to help these people, and that's good. And the fact that most of the people I know sort of think about that, want to help, that's always that cheers you up about the state of human nature. We're not as bad as sometimes we think we are, that people see somebody in need and they want to help. But the couple things to remember are, one, the distribution of money, and this is something, you know, conservatives are always saying, and most liberals understand it too, is throwing money at problems doesn't solve them. If there's not a good way, sometimes organizations end up with a ton of money and don't exactly know what they can do with it that would help the problem that it was supposed to solve. If you gave me $50,000 right now to help the people in Japan and I was just supposed to do it myself, I wouldn't know how to do it. I mean, I'd have to get over there. I wouldn't know what to, you know, buy bottled water and start handing it out. And some of these organizations, they might hit their limit at how much they're able to do with $25,000. They might not be able to hire or pay more people. They might not be equipped to do the sort of work that needs to be done in an area that's contaminated by contaminated water or by radiation. The other half of the situation, though, is just there's things going on, disasters that you don't know about. I mean, they're not as sudden. They're not as out of nowhere as Japan. And the fact almost that it's happening in a wealthy country. I saw a stat today, and I saw it on Twitter. It might not be true, but they said the Japanese earthquake was 7 times stronger than the Haiti earthquake a few years back, but that one killed 15 times as many people. And yes, we heard about that, but I mean, I bet there are people down there who are suffering quite a bit. And now that maybe not all the aid got to them, and all the money that went there, maybe more money could be directed there. So yeah, I guess the idea is if you're inspired to give by these things, just give generally to a group that you think does good work and don't try to earmark it.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, that way the Red Cross, you know, they've said essentially that they will use all of the money that they can to help the people of Japan and to help with the rebuilding effort. But in the event that there's money left over, they'll be able to use it for the next crisis. Yep. And I do think, you know, it's a thorny issue that I feel like there's probably philosophers who can speak better, to it. But that if you're inspired to give by these kind of like wrenching, sort of photographically awful events, you know, there is this question of, you know, why are we giving to Japan when your dollar could go much further in, like, the Democratic Republic of the Congo or Haiti, for that matter. And that, I think, is a sort of, like, you know, an ethical determination that people make for themselves. I don't feel totally comfortable saying don't give money to Japan because Japan is rich.
Yeah.
Although I think that it's certainly a logical argument that people can make, and maybe, you know, is also an argument towards, you know, getting the maximum utility out of your donations. But yeah, it's hard. And I agree. I'm sure your brother got a lot of hate mail. I'm sure Felix did. And I definitely did too. And it's difficult because you do want people to be wise about giving. But it is kind of, and when you talk to aid people, they point out that it is just true that people are reminded essentially to give charitably to overseas, by these sort of, you know, tragedies, and that they get these influxes of donations that they can't always use the money for. That's not true in Haiti, but I think that there's a really good chance that it'll be true in Japan. Although who knows especially with the radiation and the nuclear thing, which I think is Jesus out of everyone.
My question about radiation, and today I wasn't looking for these stories, but I haven't seen enough people sort of explain what the probabilities are of people getting sick in what sort of ways from this amount of radiation. In other words, I've seen stuff ranging from just false things about what it means for a nuclear reactor to explode to sort of statistical things, or 100 times the normal level of radiation. I don't know what that means. If I got 100 times my normal level of sodium, I wouldn't know what that means. I would need, you know, somebody with a medical background to explain it to me. Nobody's explained to me, are there people yet sick from radiation? Are there people who we are pretty sure at this point are going to? Is it going to affect, you know, China too, or even Tokyo or southern Japan? And I mean, can you point me to anything about that? I mean, that's sort of journalism I think we need right now, is people saying, this is what this level of radiation means, this is the uncertainty, and this is a range of bad things that could happen.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think the part of the answer that I've seen reading about this today is that we just don't know yet. There's actually, like, some good readings, I guess, coming out, but, you know, I heard this story that Japanese workers, like the most expert workers on this, wouldn't even get close enough to it to analyze what's happening. And so I think that we still just don't know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's tremendous uncertainty. And I think that the answer is that there is no answer yet. I have no idea. It seems like, you know, people are saying this is not as bad as Chernobyl, but it's worse than Three Mile Island. And those events seem so different to me that
that's a pretty,
you know,
big
that's
difference.
Not like a helpful guideline.
Yeah. No, that's not a helpful guideline. And the, and I guess that's the big thing, is the questions of we don't know what it means. But it's one thing I was thinking about with these nuclear things blowing up, and then again, the comparison to the Haiti earthquake where so many more people died, is a question about how wealth and development play a role in these disasters. Mm-hmm. Earthquakes and hurricanes, the damage they do, it's usually measured both in lives and in dollar amounts. And my guess from what I've seen, the wealthier a country is, the higher the dollar amount of the damage – and the lower the life cost of the damage. Think about tsunami hitting, you know, where boat people might live in Southeast Asia. Not going to cost a lot because some old rickety boats and some wharves got wrecked, but it's going to kill people. Think about whether it hits, you know, and then if you hit a really nice place in the Outer Banks, most of the people there would have evacuated, and there aren't as many people per square mile anyway. And so the sort of free market argument here is, well, wealth makes you safer and that sort of thing. But when it goes to stuff like nuclear power plants, that's a point where economic development might make this hurricane and tsunami be worse than it otherwise would have been.
Yeah, I think that that's absolutely correct. And yeah, I think that the dollar net amount could be really, really high, particularly given that there seems to be some damage to the transportation and energy infrastructure. But again, I haven't seen really good estimates of just how bad it's going to be. I don't think that there's going to be much of a long-term effect on GDP or output, anything like that. And again, you know, it helps that it seems like this was in a relatively rural area. Mm-hmm. And, you know, had this happened in Tokyo, I know people have been passing around Michael Lewis's, like, I think it was 1988, his piece on what would happen
there was an earthquake
to
in
the
Tokyo.
World economy if something happened in Tokyo, which is very very scary. But yeah, you're right that the dollar number could be really big, and you know, the hope is that there'll be kind of like perversely some sort of short-term stimulus effect when the government has to step in and really rebuild. And I imagine we'll issue special sort of rebuilding bonds. Mm-hmm. And you know, I know people are getting very worried about Japan's fiscal situation, although I tend to come down on the side of thinking that will be okay too, and that their problem remains a sort of long-term sort of structural and generational one. But it's very scary, and I agree with you that I'll be interested. I feel like, you know, once we have good data from the Japanese government or whoever it is that would let us know about the nuclear thing, but for right now it's terrifying.
Yeah. I think we can wrap up on that note of optimism there.
Yeah.
you know, if you're yeah. into praying and stuff, obviously pray for the Japanese people. Last thing on that note, it's an interesting thing. I'm a Catholic, and a lot of times, you know, and there's a point in Mass where you say, let's pray for the sick, and then they'll say, especially, and they'll name people in the parish, or let's pray for people struck by war or natural disaster, and they would say, you know, especially the people of Japan. And this plays into sort of the idea of charity. It's not an idea that we think the sick people at St. John the Evangelist are particularly worthy of God's blessings. It's that sort of, we know that there's something about the proximity and that we know about these people that gives us a special duty as individuals to take care of them. So sort of the analogy over to the giving thing, I think there's nothing wrong with the fact that people, you know, don't think about being charitable because they don't know about the folks in Congo. Maybe it's a fault of the media that they don't know about people in the Congo.
Sure.
But that if it takes a disaster like this to remind people, guess what? Not just in Japan, but all over the world, there are people who are in much worse shape than the worst people you'll see today on the streets of Washington, D.C. If it takes one of those disasters, I think that's sort of human nature, as unfortunate as it may be.
Yeah, I agree with you. And from one Irish Catholic to another, yeah,
happy St. Patrick's Day.
I agree. All best wishes, and hopefully, as much help as Japan needs. But anyway, so thanks so much.
Thank you. Talk to you later.
All right.